Good afternoon, Your Honors. Peter Walsh on behalf of the Special Litigation Committee of Prime Media. I rise simply to introduce lead counsel for the Special Litigation Committee, Gregory P. Joseph of the Gregory P. Joseph Law Offices, LLC. Mr. Joseph has been admitted pro hoc, and he will be making the remarks on behalf of the Special Litigation Committee.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you,
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jessica Zeldin from Rosenthal Monheit on behalf of the appellants. I rise to introduce my co-counsel. With me at counsel table is Judith Spanier from Abby Spanier. She will be making today's arguments on behalf of the appellants. Also with her is James Notice from Guardian Notice and Harold Opsfeld from Harold Opsfeld PC. Thank you very much.
You were just introduced to the court, sir.
Sorry.
Welcome to the court.
Ms. Spanier will be making today's argument.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. The issue on appeal today is whether a fiduciary should be required to disgorge all benefits obtained by it as a result of a breach of fiduciary duty of loyalty where the corporation has sustained no harm. Guth versus Loft, decided by this court in 1939, and virtually every case that we could find following it, until Pfeiffer, the case that presents the issue that brings us here today, supplies the answer to the question and the policy reason for requiring disgorgement in the case of breach of fiduciary duty. If an officer or director of a corporation, in violation of his duty as such, acquires gain or advantage for himself, the law charges the interest so acquired with a trust for the benefit of the corporation at its election, while it denies to the betrayer all benefit and profit. The rule, inveterate and uncompromising in its rigidity, does not rest upon the narrow ground of injury or damage to the corporation. The Guth Court then goes on and tells us what the basis for the rule is. The rule, the policy behind the rule, is a recognition of human frailty, a broader foundation of a wise public policy that, for the purpose of removing all temptation, extinguishes all possibility of profit flowing from a breach of the confidence imposed by the fiduciary relation.
Ms. Spanier, parties do seem to divide very sharply in their briefs on the related questions of what Brophy versus City Service holds and whether or not the Pfeiffer case is a proper interpretation of Brophy. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, Your Honor.
Is it the plaintiff's position that upholding the recommendation of the special committee in the Maldonado proceeding, Vice Chancellor was influenced materially by the reasoning in the Pfeiffer case?
Your Honor, that is our position, and we believe that the record supports that. The Special Litigation Committee advanced Pfeiffer as a basis for determination of the Special Litigation Committee's motion at oral argument. Obviously, it didn't raise the issue in the briefing because Pfeiffer had not yet been decided. But at oral argument, the Special Litigation Committee repeatedly, and I'm happy to provide Your Honor with the cites at pages, the transcript is attached to our opening brief at pages 9, 10, 20, and 23 of the internal references. The Special Litigation repeatedly invites Vice Chancellor Laster to consider Pfeiffer, to consider the rule that he had articulated in Pfeiffer. And the Court of Chancery accepts that invitation, and in its decision at pages 71 in connection with the first step analysis under Zapata and in connection with the second step analysis at page 77 of its decision, the Court accepts that invitation and it relies on Pfeiffer to determine that, in fact, there is no disgorgement remedy available absent a harm to the corporation, which is why we're here today, Your Honor.
So that is, as far as your side is concerned, a central legal issue.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the central legal issue. In considering this appeal today, we ask the court to consider the following hypothetical, which we believe reveals the wisdom of the inveterate, unbending rule recited in Guth versus Loft. A corporate director has the key to the company's cash box. On a Sunday morning, he goes into the office, he helps himself to $100, and heads off to the racetrack with the $100. He has a great day at the racetrack. He makes $1,000. That very afternoon, company's not open for business. It's not a corporate opportunity. Company's not open for business. The treasurer, the director, goes back to the office and replaces the $100 and puts another $100 in as well. He walks off with $800 in profit. Under the theory espoused by the Chancery Court in Pfeiffer, there's no remedy for that. There's no harm to the corporation. The corporation is ahead $100. The faithless fiduciary has taken an asset of the corporation, used it for his own benefit, has put it back, but walks off with $800 in profit. Under plaintiff's hypothetical, applying the theory of Pfeiffer to the facts of this case, under plaintiff's hypothetical, the corporate officer, director, walks off with $800. In the facts of this case, KKR, the faithless fiduciary, and we believe that Vice Chancellor Laster found that KKR traded on material inside information, KKR walks off with $150 million and no remedy for the plaintiff or for the corporation on whose behalf the plaintiff brings the case.
But there would be a remedy if the corporation got pulled into securities litigation and had to pay attorneys and all of that under Chancery's view.
That would not necessarily be a disgorgement remedy. Pfeiffer is less than perfectly clear on that topic. It talks about a damage remedy in the context of a federal securities case. But in our case today, there is no pending federal securities claim. Does that mean that the fiduciary walks away scot-free with the money? The fashion in which Pfeiffer alters Brophy, in which it limits Brophy, transforms a Brophy claim, which has two elements, materiality and intention to trade and trading on the material information. It transforms that case, if plaintiffs or the corporation wish to pursue it, into something totally other. It suddenly either becomes a fraud claim or a corporate opportunity claim. The Brophy claim gets lost in the shuffle. It ceases to exist in its simple and pure form. And therefore, it also ceases to further the policy goals behind having a simple, straightforward rule for breaches of duty of the fiduciary duty of loyalty. The policies for adhering to the Brophy rule, policies that the court mentions, that the Oracle Court mentions in the course of its discussion of Brophy, are that it's a simple remedy. It doesn't require a complicated case-by-case analysis of damages. We all know how complicated damage cases can be, particularly in the federal securities context. Here, the remedy under Brophy, disgorgement, your profit that you took as a fiduciary, you put it back.
Well, applying that to the facts of this case, what was the value of the Brophy recovery under the Vice Chancellor's view of Brophy as modified by Pfeiffer?
Under the Vice Chancellor's view of the matter, he thought this was reduced to essentially a $3 million case based solely upon KKR's last trade on November 5, 2002.
Okay, so he found that it was a $3 million case, and your claim is that if Brophy had been properly interpreted and applied to these facts, it would have been a $150 million case?
That's correct, Your Honor. The basis for that calculation, lest it not be clear from the briefing, is KKR bought roughly $222 million worth of preferred stock, the face value. It paid because it was trading on material inside information at a time where others were selling preferred, it was buying preferred. It bought that $222 million in face at $70 million, roughly three-time different. So the difference is roughly $150 million.
Now, if there had been a federal securities claim, then there would be double damages, or how would that work?
Your Honor, the concern over double damages is dealt with in a case that we cite in our brief, SEC versus Texas Gulf Sulphur, where there's a concern about the possibility of double damages. A court, particularly a court of equity, has the capacity to set the money that is recovered aside and to ensure in some fashion, in Texas Gulf Sulphur, I think it was put in a fund or a trust for 5 years so that the possibility of double damages could be eliminated. But a court of equity always has the power to structure a damage remedy so as to avoid duplicative damages.
Is it fair to say that the focus of this appeal is really on the first leg of the Maldonado-Zapata analysis and not the second?
Yes, that is fair.
Well, where does the statute of limitations factor into this? It's discussed by the Vice Chancellor, but he seems to blend the idea that if this was a $150 million claim, maybe it should be pursued notwithstanding the statute of limitation problems, but given the statute of limitation problems plus how he valued the claim, dismissal was appropriate. And the argument we hear from your opponents is the statute of limitations was more of a factor than Pfeiffer. And they seem to downplay the whole role of Pfeiffer in his analysis. So where do you think the statute of limitations bar fits into what the Vice Chancellor ultimately did?
Your Honor, I think the statute of limitations was a very small piece of it. The peculiarity, the procedural peculiarities of this case were such that the Special Litigation Committee, when it, as part of its report and investigation, evaluated the Brophy claims, it determined that there were three possible impediments to the Brophy claims. First, it said the information wasn't inside information and it wasn't material. And then it said, and besides, there's a statute of limitations problem, and dismissed it, and on those grounds and those grounds alone, because, of course, the Special Litigation Committee didn't have the benefit of Pfeiffer at the time it wrote its report. The response to that, and it's a response that's found in our brief below and in our brief here, is that none of those were sufficient grounds for recommending the dismissal of the case. Plaintiffs did not have sufficient documentation until September of 2007, when the May 21st, 2002 memo was first produced. Plaintiffs brought their claim within 3 years of discovery. Without the inside information memo, which is a very unusual document, we could not have pressed the claims with any sufficiency. If you look at most of the other cases where Brophy claims are raised, the issues in those cases and the impediment in those cases is demonstrating that there was inside information, that it was material information, and that there was trading on it. Until we received the May 21, 2002 memo in 2007, we couldn't make those connections. The May 21 memo overtly makes those connections. The Special Litigation Committee sought to avoid that portion of the memo. That's at page 5 of the memo, where KKR, the KKR people on the board of this company, Bay and Golkin and Nelson, make a recommendation because we have, because they say we've spoken to all the members of management of Primedia. We are confident that things are going better. We've talked to everyone at every level of this company, and now we're recommending because of our greater confidence, because of the information that we have. The market has information showing that Moody's is downgrading the company, S&P is downgrading the company. It's very negative. The SLC describes the company's situation as dire. Well, why was KKR buying then? The SLC doesn't really ask that question. And I'm kind of veering into the second point of our briefing. But the SLC doesn't ask the tough questions on the May 21, 2002 memo. It skirts them. It does not give them the kind of clear, straightforward questioning about the memos. It accepts secondhand statements regarding why KKR bought. The company thought KKR bought to prop it up. That is not what the May 21 memo says. KKR bought because it saw a huge opportunity for profit. And the vice chancellor recognized that. He said to the SLC during the oral argument, isn't it great? You guys had access to the information. You knew. So that makes this case different than many of the claims asserting, the Brophy claims that we've seen and the insider trading claims that we've seen. And that is why, to return to your question, the statute of limitations was a minor issue from plaintiff's perspective. We brought the claim within 3 years of getting the document that writ large tells us that KKR was engaged in insider trading. Turning for a moment back to Pfeiffer, in Pfeiffer, Vice Chancellor Laster did an extensive review of the case law, starting with Guth versus Loft, looking at Brophy directly, acknowledging that Brophy represented a case in the first instance, the Vice Chancellor describes it, as a case in which there is no corporate harm, and acknowledging that that was not an impediment to proceeding with the Brophy claim. The Chancery Court lists the many decisions following Guth versus Loft and Brophy, and it also, in that same vein, lists the many decisions of this court in which this court determined that in the case of a breach of the fiduciary duty of loyalty, the damage remedy is not to be construed narrowly. As Oberle versus Kirby states, the absence of a specific damage to a beneficiary is not the sole test for determining disloyalty by one occupying a fiduciary position. It is an act of disloyalty for a fiduciary to profit personally from the use of information secured in a confidential relationship, even if such profit or advantage is not gained at the expense of the of the beneficiary. Your Honors, that reasoning, that refusal to narrow the remedy available in the case of a breach of fiduciary duty, the Pfeiffer opinion nowhere explains the reasons for its departure. It then turns to a series of cases decided by the Chancery Court. One of those cases, Deloitte, doesn't address a Brophy claim, doesn't mention Brophy. The other three of the cases, decisions by Vice Chancellor Strine, each of them upholds Brophy and states the proposition that plaintiffs are advancing today. Disgorgement, even without any harm to the corporation.
Well, is there harm in the sense of taking a property of the company, the information?
That is certainly one of the theories underlying the use of inside information. One of the public policy reasons for retaining this rule that has been in effect in this court for almost 100 years, one of the reasons for that is that there is a benefit to corporations to be able to circulate information freely without concern that someone is going to take the information and use it for his or her own benefit. And that is the ability to freely circulate information within a corporation, according to the studies, leads to corporate wealth. Having to concern yourself that someone is going to trade on your information, you don't want to share it, is hardly the way to run a business. The You know, in the event that this court determines to uphold Pfeiffer and to affirm the dismissal, we really question what remains of the Brophy claim by changing this rule of damages available, the disgorgement remedy available. Effectively, the Pfeiffer decision eliminates Brophy in a case like this. And it does so without needing to have addressed it in the case before it, because those were not the facts of Pfeiffer. And it does so without discussion and concern for this very scenario.
You're in your rebuttal time. Did you wish to save it or continue?
I'd like to save it. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Gregory Joseph for the Special Litigation Committee. Your Honors, excuse me, we start with a dedicated Special Litigation Committee whose thoroughness of investigation and independence have been upheld by the Chancellor, whose independence isn't challenged by the plaintiffs, whose thoroughness in producing a 371-page report with 8 volumes of appendices so decimated every claim in the complaint that was filed by the plaintiffs that the only claims they now advance are 3 claims that do not appear in the complaint, 2 of which were first raised 1.5 years after the report was filed, 1 of which was first identified 5 months after they got the memo that they say triggered the claim, after they knew the factual investigation was concluded. Nonetheless, the committee had thoroughly investigated every single trade and the motivation for the trades in analyzing what was the claim at the time, which was usurpation of corporate opportunity. It diligently considered this claim, and it advanced 4 reasons without Pfeiffer why, in the business judgment of these 2 distinguished individuals, a former public company CEO and public company CFO, why this Brophy claim based on this May 21 memo was not meritorious. And the 4 reasons that it identified each independently sustains the discretion that was exercised below. First was materiality. The second was scienter. The third was timeliness. And the 4th, of course, is the indemnification obligation, which overarches all of them. And if I may, I'd like to address each of these. And the 5th, which supports, is Pfeiffer. But the context for all of this is critical. Primedia was a failing company, and these trades were viewed at the time as beneficial to Primedia. And let me be clear on that. The New York Times published an article on March 24, 2002, which is in the record, I believe it's B2901, front page business section, Sunday paper, talking about the problems at Primedia. And one of the things that it quotes is an Alex Brown, Deutsche Bank analyst, saying the company's viability is in doubt. This independent committee retained 2 financial experts, one of whom analyzed this company in detail, and its conclusion, which is a B556 quote, Primedia was a company in serious trouble. It had suffered a $1.1 billion loss in 2001. It was en route to suffering a $600 million loss, $599 million loss in 2002. This is the year we're talking about. It was losing money every quarter. It lost money in the quarter that the plaintiffs point to with this May 21 memo. It was en route to losing $1.39 during the year. It lost 12 cents of that in the second quarter. Its working capital deficiency was ballooning every quarter. It was up to more than $250 million by the second quarter of 2002. And its common stock price was collapsing. The stock price was at $4.01 the first trading day in January. It traded as low as 85 cents in August. For 13 days in July and August, this NYSE company is trading below $1 a share. The plaintiffs say that this memo, the May 21 memo, shows good news. And it shows that instead of having a $185 million loss for the first 6 months of the year, the company would be en route to having a $179 million loss. So the first question is, we have a company whose survival is in doubt. And the word on the street is, KKR has just put another company called Regal Cinema into bankruptcy. Is this company even going to survive? Is KKR going to stand behind it? So we have a situation in which these
these trades are viewed as beneficial by the company, by the board, by independent management.
Mr. Joseph,
yes, sir.
You know, trying to turn to the issues that are before us, would you agree or disagree whether or not Pfeiffer properly interprets Brophy is a material issue before us on appeal?
No, Your Honor. First of all, I looked at page 71 of the transcript, which counsel said Justice Jacobs supported the fact this was part of the step one analysis for Zapata. I saw no reference to it at all.
Well, there are several pages in the argument section of your side's brief that argue very stridently Pfeiffer does properly interpret Brophy. What are we to do with that?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that there are four other reasons that render it unnecessary on this limited record to address that issue, but I'm happy to address the Pfeiffer issue if Your Honors do consider it to be material to this determination.
Didn't the Vice Chancellor consider Pfeiffer material to the damages issue here?
He definitely considered that made a difference in whether it's a $150 million case or a $5 to $10 million case. Absolutely, Justice Richard.
Isn't that important?
It is, but I'm saying that there are independent reasons, including the statute of limitations and three others, that support the determination independently. But let me turn. I'm not minimizing the Pfeiffer issue. The question was, is it material to this decision? We believe that you can do a step one analysis of Zapata. You don't have to get to step two, and therefore it can be sustained without addressing the Pfeiffer issue, which Your Honors may decide would be better served on a more complete record than an SLC record where this claim is raised at the conclusion of the investigation and isn't even in the complaint being analyzed. But let me address the Pfeiffer issue, because we do consider that that's a significant issue. On that issue, putting aside that the committee didn't rely on it, we have a situation in which there is concededly no harm to the company because there's no dispute that there was no usurpation of corporate opportunity. The company could not make the trades. It was unable to do that. In addition, we have the undisputed fact that in the company's eyes, it was beneficial to have KKR purchasing the stock. And we have that from members of the board. We have that from members of management, including former members of management, having nothing to do with this company, no relationship to KKR. We have the fact that at the time the company is touting these purchases in the October 31, 2002 press conference, this shows that Primedia is going to be a survivor. And I would say that this is not a situation in which it is clear there's a need for a redundant state remedy when there is a federal remedy where there's not only no harm to the company, but the trades affirmatively help the company.
Well, where does that come from? It is correct, is it not, that Brophy stands for the classic fiduciary doctrine that where a fiduciary uses proprietary, non-public information, trades on it, and makes a profit in violation of that fiduciary's duty of loyalty, disgorgement is the appropriate remedy, or at least an appropriate remedy, irrespective of harm to the beneficiary. Would you agree that Brophy says that?
I would agree that, Your Honor, that is the conclusion. The facts of the case, the holding of the case, we had competition with the company for shares, but it does say that.
All right. And until the Pfeiffer case, is there any case, any decision either by this court or the Court of Chancery that purports to limit the breadth of that potential remedy based on the federal security scheme?
The debate is set forth in Oracle, but that wasn't a holding in Oracle. It wasn't what the chancellor needed to reach in that case.
And so the first time this limitation was engrafted on Brophy was by the vice chancellor in Pfeiffer itself?
Yes, Justice Jacobs.
Was there any reasoned analysis of the federal security scheme that led the court to that conclusion?
Well, there was an analysis of the federal security scheme to show that the federal security scheme did not completely occupy the field. And then the question is, as this court decided in Malone, when is it necessary or appropriate to have a state remedy which is redundant of a federal remedy? And that is the analysis that the court went through in Malone. That is the effective analysis of Pfeiffer. But I would suggest to you that whenever you want to make a decision on that issue, it might behoove the court to have a more complete record. But here, where the purchases affirmatively are seen to help the company, the repercussions of a finding that there is a remedy here could be that a controlling shareholder is going to think long and hard about making an investment in a controlled company at a time when the company needs it, welcomes it, and benefits from it. And that's the investment by just going out. It was buying on the market. It wasn't buying from the company, but it was showing its support by going out in the market at a time when the company could not do that.
Of course, this was a...
Go ahead. In similar circumstances, couldn't you have solved that problem by disclosing the favorable information, or arguably favorable information, and then going out and making all your purchases?
Justice Berger, of course, there can always be a disclosure.
You seem to be suggesting that the company would have suffered if these purchases weren't made and it was an actual benefit to the company, and basically, you know, there should be no relief here because as compared to Brophy, where you say there was no harm, this is even better than Brophy. There's a benefit. And does it make any difference that this was a benefit to the company, even if it were?
Your Honor, we believe that the information, if you read the May 5 memo, the ultimate conclusion that is drawn by KKR is that the company will be able to achieve its street guidance, which is what the information is that the sellers of these shares had. We believe that this information, if it is analyzed, it says that the next quarter, it expects to exceed EBITDA by $6 million. It expects for the year that it's going to lose $5 million on an apples-to-apples comparison. And the conclusion that KKR draws is that it will meet street guidance. So we believe, we've set forth an analysis as to why this was not material information, as well as the fact we think it is unnecessary to reach the issue, the Brophy issue. We had a situation in which the question isn't an impact on the common stock price. The question is, we have $1.9 billion in debt that is standing in front of the preferred shareholders, who are the sellers. These are enormously sophisticated people. In the report, the names are reflected: Fidelity, Oppenheimer, Quadrangle. If you look in the record, Bank of America. I mean, these are sophisticated sellers. We have an expert report that analyzed the market and concluded that the market acted in an economically rational way to announcements of the company. We have a situation in which there was no stock price movement after the announcement was made. The preferred stock did not move at all. The common moved for 3 days, after which it plummeted to the pre-announcement prices and continued to trade below $1 a share. So there's the view of the committee was this wasn't material information to sophisticated preferred stockholders, because once the information was announced, it did not affect any of the trading in the shares. There was also, Your Honor, a firm conviction on the part of the committee that there was no scienter pled here. The theory of the plaintiffs is paragraph 67 of the third amended complaint. It's the same in the prior ones, and that is that KKR forced the company to sell assets to redeem preferred stock that Primedia obtained. Professor Jarrell performed an economic analysis demonstrating that KKR had spent $1 billion acquiring 60% of the common stock. It had a grand total of 47% of these classes of preferred that were redeemed. That means that it lost money by having the company transfer assets to the preferred at the expense of the common. For every dollar that was spent by the company to redeem, the KKR was out 60 cents. For every dollar that was received by the preferred holders, it received less than 60 cents. So there was also the conclusion by the special committee that there was no scienter, but there's an additional conclusion by this committee on the scienter point, and that is there are several factors that demonstrate factually why this doesn't show scienter. Putting aside that theory, and that is the theory of this complaint.
Well, Mr. Jester, before you go to that point, in this transcript of the proceedings, where the vice chancellor is looking at this from the perspective of whether the insider trading claim has merit, he uses the term, you know, this would blow through a motion to dismiss or something to that effect. And then his ultimate conclusion under Zapata is that the claim doesn't have much value, again, somewhat related to Pfeiffer. So you're telling us all these things about why it was good for the company, why there was no scienter, but didn't the vice chancellor reach a different conclusion?
Justice Holland, we're beyond the motion to dismiss stage. I mean, the Special Litigation Committee conducted 21 interviews, 140,000 documents, and we have detailed facts that can offset. Well, it would indeed pass a motion to dismiss.
I understand where we are. I'm just trying to understand that part of the ruling where he said, you know, if I was just looking at this on whether the allegations of insider trading would get to go forward, he seems to suggest that they would.
I agree with that 100%.
So my question is, if we agree, he said, the insider trading allegations would probably go forward, has he not implicitly discounted what you're telling us about the absence of scienter and why this is good for the company?
Your Honor, I will say that you could conclude that way, but he also commends the thoroughness of this investigation, the independence of the analysis. And I believe that these are alternative grounds for affirmance. And on a step one step one of Zapata, we need not get to these issues because we do have a thorough investigation by independent actors in good faith, sophisticated parties. But I'm not going to discount. The record is exactly as you say. He did say that. He also concurred that there's a serious issue on the statute of limitations, which is another ground that the committee identified. And he concurred that there is going to be the indemnification expense because the claim is asserted against three KKR directors who have indemnification rights, which is another ground that the committee identified. It's true he did not address these.
Those are all, putting aside the limitations issue, the indemnification ground is an offset against whatever the court would find, however preliminarily, would be the damage, the amount of damages. Is that right?
Certainly, Your Honor.
If we're talking about $150 million versus $3 million,
if the calculus changes. Certainly the calculus is affected by that. This committee was viewing this as a potentially $150 million case at the time that it concluded in its business judgment after a seven-month-long investigation that it didn't think that it had merit to pursue.
So the committee did not apply the Pfeiffer rule?
Not at all, Justice Ridgeley. That decision had not been rendered. The committee acted on the basis of materiality, scienter, timeliness, and then the indemnification cause.
Well, that goes back to my question, though. And that's what the committee said. But what did the vice chancellor think of those conclusions by the committee?
Well, the vice chancellor did not address scienter. You know, he did say that this would pass through a motion to dismiss, which implicitly would suggest on materiality he thought that it was sufficiently material. On timeliness, he indicated that he agreed there was a litigable issue, which was a ground the committee identified, which is an alternate ground. I can't minimize what he said about the Pfeiffer decision. That is part of what he said. That was something that I raised in argument, as I said at the time. It was going to be the last point I was going to make. I made it the first point because he wanted to talk about the Pfeiffer decision, and it certainly is a factor that supports the committee's conclusion, but it wasn't the basis of the committee's decision. And the committee's decision stands without that. And if on a pure step one analysis, there's no need to reach the Pfeiffer issue, which, again, we have a Kaplan against Wyatt issue here. They're intentionally sitting in wait for months with this claim. We understand that they're trying this. They want this as a corporate opportunity claim. That's what's in the first three versions of this complaint. They get this memo on September 7, 2007. We invite them to make presentations to them. They make a presentation to us. We have an open-door policy. We talk to them again in January. We talk to them a second time in January. On January 18th, after all the factual investigation is concluded and we're finalizing the report, we've just gotten an extension from them to finalize the report, the first time they raised this Brophy issue. Now, the committee did consider it diligently, but if Kaplan against Wyatt means anything, it can't mean that when you've got this sitting there, you have the right to sit back, not raise the issue, and then attack the committee for a thoroughness on a claim that you've never identified. And that's what the complaint is in the appellant's brief. It's a failure to investigate an unasserted claim. There's no, they're not pressing any claim which is in the complaint.
So if this went forward, we'd need a fourth amended complaint.
Well, they filed the third amended complaint on the day they responded to our motion. Not on the day that we, you know, when we made the motion and did the investigation, we did not have this issue. About a year and a half after the report was filed, they identified this issue in the third amended complaint, which still has the theory of scienter that the company was forced by KKR, which we found no evidence of, and found all evidence to the contrary, which is why the court said...
Was leave granted to file the third amended
Yes, complaint? It was. So the third amended complaint was filed. It was filed in March of 2010. The report, I believe, was filed in March of 2010. The report is filed in 2008.
But by then, the committee's work was already done.
Yes. The committee's work was completed. We were able to consider the Brophy claim because the factual investigation had gone through all of these trades, and the committee did diligently consider that claim, and that's why it took us another month to finalize that report after January 18th. I believe the final date of the report is February 18th. But they should not be rewarded for sitting back and not asserting a claim when they have it there for months if they want to assert it. And counsel just said that as of September 7, 2007, she was aware of this claim. They're talking to us. They're saying nothing about this. And we're talking to them to say, look, we're seeing problems with the claims you've raised. Help me. What is the solution to the statute of limitations problem? What is the solution on the corporate opportunity when there's no money? You know, they're not responding in any way that helps us get beyond any of the claims identified. We went further than is in the complaint because we read the complaint and said, you know, there's a vestigial claim for corporate opportunity. That wasn't pled as a cause of action. And we said, are you asserting that? They said, yes, so we investigated that. Nothing about this claim. So now this special litigation committee, at a significant expense, goes through this entire process, and at the end, they come up with one claim, and then a year and a half later, they come up with two more. I mean, it's a totally unworkable situation as a practical matter. And that's why I suggest to your honors that the step one analysis of Zapata doesn't necessitate getting into this. It doesn't reward them for identifying an issue after the fact.
But what is the record support for your assertion that the Special Litigation Committee looked at this as a $150 million claim?
But because we didn't have FIFR. There was nothing in there that suggested it was anything less. I mean, that's the entirety of it. There was no suggestion that it was less than $150 million. We knew that they actually paid $75 million for the securities.
But what we're hearing is that by the time of the argument before Vice Chancellor Laster, the company, the Special Litigation Committee, had concluded it really was worth only a few million dollars.
We argued that that was a supporting factor for what the Special Litigation Committee did, but that wasn't the Special Litigation Committee's analysis. But certainly, that was a change in the law that we had to address. It was by the Vice Chancellor. So we did address that. I mean, what counsel is trying to do is to convert this into an appeal from FIFR, when in fact that had nothing to do with the claims that they had asserted in the complaint that was being reviewed, and they intentionally withheld it so that it wouldn't be the subject of any more analysis than would be able to be done after all the factual work was done. Now, that, as I said, the committee independently had four separate reasons why this was not a sufficient claim, and these gentlemen viewed this task as valuing an asset, and they took it seriously as though this were a claim of theirs to personally recover from. The conclusion was that if you look at this information, you look at the debt structure, you see that the stock's not moving on this information, it wasn't material. You look at their theory. Their theory is the company is being coerced to buy out the preferred by its 60% holder. It's an economically irrational situation. And if you look, and there are more issues on Scienter. This memo is dated May 21. First purchase is made 7 weeks later. And on July 23, which is about after KKR has bought 30 million shares, it says to the company, look, why don't you do this? Why don't you cut out all dividends, and that'll force the stock, the preferred, to swap out with you? You know, that's not showing that KKR is trying to capitalize on this information. It's corroborative of the fact that they're trying to be supportive of the company. So we have the situation, not only do the purchases begin only 7 weeks after the memo, they continue beyond the quarter to which the memo relates. We have a significant disagreement within KKR as to whether to buy anything more because they've got $1 billion invested in this company. There's no record that they're trying to seize on this information. We have a record in which KKR says it's trying to help the company, and by its actions, by actually saying, look, just cut out the dividends, force them to sell to you, to exchange to you. The company decides not to. Matt Flynn, independent CFO who's now gone, says that would have been operating in a winding up mode. We want to be able to go back to the markets. We didn't do that. But that doesn't show a motivation to be hurting this company, to be capitalizing on inside information. They were willing to stand back at all times. And the company welcomed these trades because it was beneficial to the company. So we suggest, Your Honors, that a step one analysis, particularly in light of the gaming of the system that we see here, where they say nothing about this claim until after the investigation is over, then add two more a year and a half later, that it's sufficient to end with a step one analysis and not address the FIFER issue. If FIFER is addressed, we do argue as to why we believe it is a correct statement of law, why it's a rational statement of the law, given that there are other federal remedies that exist as well. But it shouldn't be that a controlling shareholder in these circumstances is disincentivized, because controlling shareholders almost by definition are going to have inside information and be subject to these claims.
Now, FIFER has been stayed pending the outcome of this appeal, I understand.
Your Honor, I don't know the procedural history of that. I apologize. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Is that correct? FIFER has been stayed?
Your Honor, I'm not fortunate enough to be a party to FIFER. I have no idea.
But your firm is?
No.
Or Rosenthal is, rather.
Is stayed, Your Honor.
Thank you.
This appeal does not relate to what plaintiffs did. We received a memo buried in a lot of discovery in September of 2007. We didn't know on September of 2007 when we got the memo that had happened. Thereafter, we start to get hundreds and indeed tens of thousands of pages from the special committee. We're busy analyzing it. This is not about what plaintiffs didn't do. The issue before the court, insofar as Zapata is concerned, is about what the special litigation committee did here. The special litigation committee...
Well, the counter-argument is, to some extent, it is about what the plaintiffs didn't do. The claims that are the subject of the present proceeding were not embodied in a complaint until 2 years after the report was filed. The information that you argue was critical to your side's making, connecting the dots, was made available to your side before the report was filed. So, the conclusion that the other side would have us draw is that your side has got a Kaplan versus Wyatt problem. Can you address that?
Your Honor, we received the memo in September of 2007. There were meetings with the special committee's counsel in January of 2008, at which meetings I believe the issue of the insider trading and the May 21 memo were in fact discussed. The committee says in its report that even though we didn't raise it immediately upon receiving the document, that it knew about it. It was obvious. They don't know why plaintiffs didn't raise it, but the claim was obvious to them. Those are their words. And they investigated it, and they investigated it thoroughly, they say. So I don't think there's any harm to the committee. And really, of course, the issue here is not about plaintiffs. This is a derivative claim. This is what's going to happen to the asset of this corporation. I think we can't lose sight of the fact that this is the corporation's claim. The Special Litigation Committee was appointed not just to examine the claims, but to examine all the circumstances surrounding the claims. And it looked at this. It recognized the existence of the claim. And it dismissed it for reasons totally rejected by Vice Chancellor Laster on materiality, on intentionality.
Let me perhaps phrase the question a little more sharply. Was it possible for your side to file what is now the third amended complaint before the committee filed its report?
Your Honor, I don't think that it was. I think there were aspects of the report that revealed to us materials that we were not aware of. It wasn't simply an issue of document production. The committee had access to 21 different witnesses. There were facts of which we were not aware. For example, the committee talks about learning of the oral agreement between KKR and Primedia, whereby KKR would defer to Primedia in terms of trading in the market for the preferred. That's not in any document. That is part of our third amended complaint. There were a variety of facts that only presented themselves in the report. The transaction concerning American Baby, the committee's conclusion about the clear materiality of American Baby and the of that transaction on the company. So there were a variety of things that we were not in possession of. I would just like to turn to one or two other matters. The Special Litigation Committee places a great deal of emphasis for the purposes of materiality on the trading in the preferred. There was no trading market in the preferred. Its experts had virtually no data for this time period. It had data for weekly data, not actual trading data on a day-by-day, moment-by-moment basis. One of the KKR witnesses testified that the preferred traded in an illiquid market. The common, on the other hand, traded in an efficient market on the New York Stock Exchange, and the common stock movement was something that the SLC's experts simply ignored. It ignored the preferred movement altogether for the July 31, 2002 release.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for an interesting argument. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.